larger forces at work and the scapegoating of colored migrants, those with the least power of all, made the violence all the more tragic. Contrary to conventional wisdom, the decline in property values and neighborhood prestige was a byproduct of the fear and tension itself, sociologists found. The decline often began, they noted, in barely perceptible ways before the first colored buyer moved in. The instability of a white neighborhood under pressure from the very possibility of integration put the neighborhood into a kind of real estate purgatory. It set off a downward cycle of anticipation in which worried whites no longer bought homes in white neighborhoods that might one day attract colored residents, even if none lived there at the time. Rents and purchase prices were dropped in a futile attempt to attract white residents, as Hirsch put it. With prices falling and the neighborhood's future uncertain, lenders refused to grant mortgages or made them more difficult to obtain. Panicked whites sold at low prices to salvage what equity they had left, giving the homeowners who remained little incentive to invest any further to keep up or improve their properties. Thus, many white neighborhoods began declining before colored residents even arrived, Hirsch noted. There emerged a perfect storm of nervous owners, falling prices, vacancies unfillable with white tenants or buyers, and a market of colored buyers who may not have been able to afford the neighborhood at first, but now could with prices within their reach. The arrival of colored home buyers was often the final verdict on a neighborhood's falling property value, rather than the cause of it. Many colored people, already facing wage disparities, either could not have afforded a neighborhood on the rise, or would not have been granted mortgages except by lenders and sellers with their backs against the wall. It was the falling home values that made it possible for colored people to move in at all. The downward spiral created a vacuum that speculators could exploit for their own gain. They could scoop up properties in potentially unstable white neighborhoods and extract higher prices from colored people who were anxious to get in and were accustomed to being overcharged in the Black Belt. The panic peddler and the respectable broker earned the greatest profits, Hirsch wrote, from the greatest degree of white desperation. It seemed as if little had changed from the hostilities of the early years of the migration, when colored tenants on Vincennes Avenue got the following notice. "We are going to blow these flats to hell, and if you don't want to go with them, you had better move at once. Only one warning." The letter writers carried out their threat. Three bombs exploded over the following 2 weeks. 30 years later, things were no better, and may actually have been worse, as the Black Belt strained to hold the migrants still pouring in, even as the borders with white neighborhoods were being more vigorously defended. By the late 1950s, Ida May and George, now both working blue-collar jobs, and their children now adults and with blue-collar jobs of their own, were dreaming of finding a place where they could pool their incomes and live together under one roof. But it would be some time before they were in a position to act, or could find a safe and affordable place to go. At the same time, an urban turf war had risen up around them. Bombings, shootings, riots, or threats greeted the arrival of nearly every new colored family in white defended territory. The biggest standoffs came between the groups with the most in common, save race: the working class white immigrants and the working class black immigrants, both with similar backgrounds and wanting the same thing, good jobs and a decent home for their families, but one group not wanting to be anywhere near the other and literally willing to fight to the death to keep the other out. It was a chilling parallel to the war playing out at the very same time in the South, from the arrest of Rosa Parks in 1955 for refusing to give up a bus seat in Alabama, to white troops blocking 9 colored students in 1957 on their first day of school in Little Rock, Arkansas, after the Supreme Court said they had the right to enroll. After World War II, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and other northern and western cities would witness a fitful migration of whites out of their urban strongholds. The far-out precincts and the inner-ring suburbs became sanctuaries for battle-weary whites seeking, with government incentives, to replicate the havens they once had in the cities. One such suburb was Dearborn, Michigan, just outside Detroit. By the mid-1950s, Dearborn was swelling with white refugees from the city. The suburb's mayor, Orville Hubbard, told the Montgomery Advisor in Alabama that the whites had been crowded out of Detroit by the colored people. He was more than happy to welcome these new white residents and said, to the delight of Southern editorialists, "These people are so anti-colored, much more than you in Alabama." Having already fled the cities, the newcomers were not going to let colored people into their new safe hold. "Negroes can't get in here," Mayor Hubbard told the Southerners. "Every time we hear of a Negro moving in, we respond quicker than you do to a fire." Decades later, the message would still hang in the air, the calculus pretty much the same. By the end of the 20th century, blacks would make up more than 80% of the population of Detroit. Just across the Ford Expressway, the black population of the suburb of Dearborn, the 2000 census found, was 1%. New York, 1963. George Swanson Starling. Every night, the violence came into George Starling's living room. He had been watching the nightly news, the grainy black-and-white images of colored teenagers standing up to Southern sheriffs, and he could see himself as a young man again, pressing against the barbed wall of the caste system in Florida. Sheriff's deputies were pounding the young people with fire hoses and beating them with batons. This was the South, he left. He wondered if it would ever change. He was on the subway one morning, heading to work at Pennsylvania Station, in the midst of this Southern assault. He got settled in his seat and opened the newspaper. "I looked at the front page," he said, "and there's all these black people down on the ground, and dogs jumping all over them, and the cops standing over them with billies and beating on them down in Alabama on a march." Something welled up in George. Everything raced before him. The cheating foreman in the groves, his running for his life, the hangings and burnings, the little Southern dog that would rather die than be black, the bomb going off on Christmas Day under the bed of a good man trying to bring justice to Florida. And then there was New York, wide open and stifling at the same time. Yes, he was alive, but it was a slow death in a hard city. He was a baggage handler for all intents and purposes, and would be no more than that, no matter how much potential he had. The city was pressing down on him and swallowing up his children. It never failed to remind him that he was seen as alien, the Yankee bartender taking the trouble to break the glass George had drunk from rather than use it again. There was no place else to run, and now the heat was turning up in the South again. Hosing and police dogs, and people watching it as if it were a made-for-TV movie, and the blacks just having to take it like they had for generations. "I had the paper in front of my face," he said, "and I got so mad. I dropped the paper down, and when I dropped the paper, I'm looking right in a white man's face just sitting across from me. I'd never seen the man before, didn't know him from Adam, but he was white. And the hatred just surged up in me after looking at this thing in the paper. I just wanted to hurt somebody white. And I had to just really restrain myself to keep from just getting up. And that was the thing that went on during the whole campaign," as he called the civil rights movement. George got hold of himself. He pulled himself back from the edge. This thing was driving him crazy, and there was nothing he could do about it. The white man probably never had a clue. George would go about his job on the train, and no one would know the difference. But the despair did not leave him. He still had loved ones in the South. "I was worried about all my family and friends," he said. "I had a lot of people there. My father and mother were living, my brother and all the kids that I went to school with, and my wife's people. There were a lot of people that I was concerned with." He saw the fear firsthand on the faces of colored passengers heading north, and in his tense interactions with white Southerners when he worked the rails going south. As bad as it was, and as bad as it had been all those decades before, some of the most bold-faced terrors of the civil rights movement were yet to come. The bombing deaths of four little girls just before a Sunday church service in Birmingham, the assassinations of civil rights workers, black and white, Andrew Goodman, James Chaney and Michael Schwerner, and Medgar Evers, the confrontation on a bridge in Selma, Alabama. Those would not come until Jim Crow's fitful last hours. George kept close contact with the people back home, and like many migrants in the North, sent money to support the protests, because the migrants knew more than most anyone what the people back home were up against. One day in 1962, in the middle of the civil rights movement, he heard something that set him off again. By civil rights standards, it was a relatively small thing, and that is what drew him to it. For some reason, nothing seemed as fate-tempting and blasphemous as someone setting fire to three defenseless colored churches, as in Georgia in September 1962. They were razed to the ground by white supremacists bent on keeping colored people from something as basic as signing up to vote. George was raised in the church and felt it hallowed and sanctified, and the only safe place even the old slaveholders had dared not enter. It represented a breach of the most private, holy space. He read in the New York Amsterdam News that there was a drive on to raise money to rebuild the churches. He started a collection himself. He went to the underpaid cooks and baggage men and red caps and porters working the rails with him. He got 50 cents here and a dollar there from people like Walter Watkins from Washington, D.C., Ralph Covington from Brooklyn, Van Truitt from the Bronx, G.T. Craig from Baltimore, J.E. Aaron of Brooklyn, and 38 other co-workers. It took him 4 weeks to raise $41. In January 1963, he walked over to the office of the Amsterdam News and handed a check in that amount to a rebuilding fund the paper was sponsoring. With George, it was never the money when it came to these things, but the sense of indignation over the injustice of it all, and about doing something, anything, and getting other people as roused up about it as he was, just like he did back in the orange groves in Florida all those years ago. He had been in Harlem and working for the railroad for 18 years now, and knew he and his co-workers could raise more than a few dollars to help fight bigotry in the region they left. The Amsterdam News soon closed the fund, figuring it had raised all it was going to get. The churches in Georgia had already begun rebuilding with donations that had come in from all over the country. But George hadn't stopped collecting money. He kept a ledger of all the men who contributed and what they contributed, each 50-cent and dollar increment, from Percy Brown of Mount Vernon, Yace Brown of Queens, Adolph Thomas of Philadelphia. In March, George showed up again at the newspaper office with a check for $44 more. "I wanted to help in the only way I know," he told the Amsterdam News. Los Angeles, August 1961. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. Robert was in regular contact with the folks back home, and in one of his phone calls to Monroe, his big brother Madison mentioned that he was due for some upcoming surgery, what seemed on the face of it to be fairly routine, the problem being his gallbladder. But Robert, a surgeon of many years now, knew that nothing involving surgery was routine, and urged his brother to come out to California where he could get the best of medical care. Robert would make all the arrangements, and Madison wouldn't have to submit to the small-town, probably proficient but still segregated medicine back in Louisiana. "Come," Robert told him. "I don't want those white doctors in Monroe operating on you. You come out here so I'll know what kind of care you're getting." Madison had heard about the state-of-the-art facilities in Los Angeles. He knew his brother would see to it that he got the very best. That was just the way Robert was, and he couldn't help himself. So although the trip out west would be taxing, he decided to leave his wife Harriet and son Madison James in Monroe and follow his little brother's advice and come to L.A. "He had confidence in me," Robert said. Robert set about planning the best medical care for his brother. He hand-picked the surgeon, board-certified, it went without saying, who was one of his most trusted friends. On the day of the operation, Robert was there in his scrubs in the operating room, serving as second assistant and watching every move. And when he picked the knife up to make the incision, Robert remembered, I closed my eyes and flinched. I felt it. I couldn't assist with that attitude. So the surgeon said, Bob, you let Palmer Reed move up and you step back so I can sponge. And I settled down. Robert stayed for the duration of the surgery. I saw everything, and it was a flawless operation. It was beautiful. There was no mistake made, none. He felt proud and vindicated that he had insisted that his big brother come out to California and that things had gone so well. To Robert, it was just one more way to prove to the brother who had stayed in the South that he had made the right decision to migrate and that things really were better in California. Robert was in a great mood and started joking with his brother that maybe he should recuperate at Robert's house or with their sister Gold, who by now Robert had lured to California too. You wasting money in a private room, Robert said. Come to my house and go live with Gold. Okay, Madison said. I'll be ready to go. I just don't feel good right now. 3 or 4 days after surgery, Madison was still saying he didn't feel good. He started sending out for antacids to relieve his abdominal pressure, but he wasn't complaining. And he didn't have any symptoms that would make us want to do anything special, Robert later said. We know there's a certain amount of discomfort you're going to have. He was taking soft foods, and he was up. He was ambulated the next day after surgery. Temperature was flat. He was doing fine. After several more days, a nurse woke Robert up one morning. Dr. Foster, this is Miss Smart. I'm calling you about Dr. Madison Foster. Yes? He went to the bathroom, Dr. Foster. Robert heard the gravity in her voice, the succinctness of her message, and knew what it meant, could read her shorthand. Madison must have strained himself, and in the straining, dislodged some plaque that could be anywhere in his body, in his heart, his lungs, his brain. There was no telling where it could be. Robert got straight to the point. Is he alive? The nurse told him yes, and that they had called in several doctors to attend to him. Fine, Robert said, suspecting that it wasn't. At once he began calling in the specialists he knew, and then he rushed to the hospital. Madison's hospital room was full of doctors. They were surrounding his bedside, all working on him. And I'll never forget the look in his eyes, Robert said, his head down now. And he's looking at me, and that look in his eye was saying, Is this it? Little Bubba, he called me. Little Bub, is this it? He was so worried, and I'm crying and talking. Robert tried to comfort him. Don't worry, Bubba, Robert said. It's all right. It's going to be all right. Madison was a physician himself and knew that it wasn't. He knew I was only reassuring him, Robert would later say, because why would I be crying? Robert got on the phone with Madison's wife, Harriet, who was still awaiting word back in Monroe about how the gallbladder surgery had gone. I gave her an hour-to-hour report, he said, and that went on all day. Instead of saving his brother in California, Robert would end up sending Madison back home in a casket, the people in Monroe clucking over Robert's so-called promised land, and what a shame it all was. Harriet would hold it against him for years. Madison had died of a blood clot. That had been the source of his discomfort, and nothing, it seemed, could have prevented it. Robert would have been the first to blame the doctors if it had happened in the South, but this had been in California, and he had chosen the surgeons and seen the operation with his own eyes. Robert would blame himself for as long as he lived, torture himself with what would have happened if, and would never truly get over it. Revolutions. I can conceive of no Negro native to this country who has not by the age of puberty been irreparably scarred by the conditions of his life. The wonder is not that so many are ruined, but that so many survive. James Baldwin, Notes of a Native Son. Chicago, 1966. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. One day in 1966, something hopeful called to Ida Mae, who was now 53 and a grandmother. She scuttled past the dime stores and beauty shops on 63rd Street with Eleanor's little children, Karen and Kevin, in tow. They were rushing in the direction of a quavering voice on a loudspeaker. Up ahead she could see a crowd of onlookers, the faithful and the curious, packed in the street and on the sidewalks near Halsted, and sober-faced police officers circling the crowd on horseback. She arrived late and out of breath. Years later, all she would remember was the voice saying something about little white children and little colored children, or so she thought, and all the people, hordes of them, straining to hear but tense from the police scrutiny and the vaguely dangerous nature of the moment. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was there in person and speaking before them. It was one of his rare appearances in Ida Mae's neighborhood during his first major attempt to bring the civil rights movement to the North. Ida Mae almost missed it. She arrived too late to get anywhere near the podium. Neither she nor Karen or Kevin could see over the crowd that had gathered long before them. "They had him way up on something high," she said decades later, "and you could hear his voice talking through those horns." Ida Mae wanted to move closer to see him. That was what she had come for, after all. "I never did get close enough," she said. "I didn't want to push through the crowd. Everybody was so touchy. And I had kids, you see, and I just couldn't pull them up in there. I never did get to see him good." Ida Mae was taken in by the sheer presence of the man, who by then had already won the Nobel Peace Prize, led the March on Washington, witnessed the signing of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and overseen his epic battles against Jim Crow in places like Selma and Montgomery. But Chicago was a turning point for King. His movement was aging, its actions drawing greater skepticism, and its successes leaving him with fewer obvious dragons to slay. It was a campaign looking for a cause. The inroads into Southern segregation gave King a greater awareness of the unresolved tensions in the North in the wake of the Great Migration. "Negroes have continued to flee from behind the cotton curtain," King told a crowd at Buckingham Fountain near the Loop, testing out a new theme in Virgin Territory. "But now they find that after years of indifference and exploitation, Chicago has not turned out to be the new Jerusalem." Yet the very thing that made black life hard in the North, the very nature of Northern hostility, unwritten, mercurial, opaque, and eminently deniable, made it hard for King to nail down an obvious right versus wrong cause to protest. Blacks in the North could already vote and sit at a lunch counter or anywhere they wanted on an elevated train. Yet they were hemmed in and isolated into two overcrowded sections of the city, the South Side and the West Side, restricted in the jobs they could hold and the mortgages they could get, their children attending segregated and inferior schools, not by edict as in the South, but by circumstance in the North, with the results pretty much the same. The unequal living conditions produced the expected unequal results. Blacks working long hours for overpriced flats, their children left unsupervised and open to gangs, the resulting rise in crime and drugs, with few people able to get out, and the problem so complex as to make it impossible to identify a single cause or solution. King was running headlong into what the sociologist Gunnar Myrdal called the Northern Paradox. "In the North," Myrdal wrote, "almost everybody is against discrimination in general. But at the same time, almost everybody practices discrimination in his own personal affairs. That is, by not allowing blacks into unions or clubhouses, certain jobs and white neighborhoods, indeed avoiding social interaction overall. It is the culmination of all these personal discriminations," he continued, which creates the color bar in the North, and for the Negro, causes unusually severe unemployment, crowded housing conditions, crime, and vice. About this social process, the ordinary white Northerner keeps sublimely ignorant and unconcerned. Thus, any civil rights campaign in the North would not be an attack on outrageous laws that, with enough grit and fortitude, could be overturned with the stroke of a pen. Instead, King would be fighting the ill-defined fear and antipathy that made Northern whites flee at the sight of a black neighbor, turn away blacks at realty offices, or not hire them if they chose. The enemy was a feeling, a general unease that led to the flight of white people and businesses, and sucked the resources out of the ghettos the migrants were quarantined into. No laws could make frightened white Northerners care about blacks enough to permit them full access to the system they dominated. So long as this city is dominated by whites, whether because of their numbers, without force, or by their force if they were in the minority, the Chicago Tribune once wrote, there will be limitations placed on the black people. Still, despite the odds, King was compelled to go north, was called to it, he said, as had a good portion of his people in the still unfolding migration. He had made the journey himself when he went to Boston University for graduate school, and while there met his wife, Coretta, another Southerner. King's campaign in the North was, in one sense, simply reacting to a major shift in the epicenter of black America, the historian James R. Ralph wrote. It was following the great demographic flow of black Americans from the rural South to the urban North. King actually moved into an apartment in the most hard-scrabble section of town, the West Side neighborhood of North Lawndale, where the poorest and most recent arrivals from the South had shakily established themselves. He had a chess-like series of encounters with Mayor Richard J. Daley, the mayor boss of Chicago, who managed to outwit the civil rights leader at nearly every turn. For one thing, Daley knew not to make the same mistakes as his Southern counterparts. He met with King, appearing cooperative rather than ignoring him or having him thrown into jail. He vowed to protect the marchers with a heavy police presence that sometimes outnumbered the marchers. It worked so well that the protesters rarely had the chance to contrast their peaceable courage against foaming-at-the-mouth supremacists, because Daley's police force didn't let any white mob get near them, which kept the protests off the news and kept the movement from gaining traction, just as Daley had hoped. That is, until after months of build-up, King went to march against housing segregation in a neighborhood called Marquette Park on the city's southwest side. This was a working-class neighborhood of Poles, Lithuanians, Germans, and Italians who had not long since gotten their starter bungalows and were standing their ground against the very thought of colored people moving in. It was August 5th, 1966. A fist-shaking crowd of some 4,000 residents had gathered in advance. Upon his arrival, they cursed King with epithets from a knoll overlooking the march. Many people in the crowd waved Confederate flags. Some wore Nazi-like helmets. One placard read, King would look good with a knife in his back. The march had barely begun when a heckler hurled a rock as big as a fist at King, striking him in the head, just above the right ear. He fell to his knees, and as he tried to get up, the crowd pelted the demonstrators with bottles, eggs, firecrackers, and more rocks. Some in the crowd turned and smashed rocks into cars and buses that passed with colored people in them. Some 1,200 police officers and 200 plainclothesmen had gathered in anticipation of trouble, but this was one of the rare occasions that they were outnumbered by white residents primed for confrontation. As the 800 King supporters tried to carry on the march, they passed men, women, and children on their front stoops, who called the marchers cannibals, savages, and worse. A column of 300 jeering white teenagers sat in the middle of the street to block the marchers' path. The police dispersed the youths with nightsticks waving, and the march was able to resume. But the teenagers repositioned themselves half a block down and sat in the street again. It took a second charge from the police to break up the young hecklers. When the march wound down, the mob chased the buses carrying King's people away. Rising in agitation that lasted for hours, the mob smashed an effigy of King, overturned a car on Marquette Road, stoned other cars, and fought police trying to clear the place out, requiring reinforcements to beat the mob back with clubs and shots fired into the air. In the end, some 30 people were injured and 40 were arrested. Some of King's aides had warned him not to go to Chicago. He said he had to. "I have to do this," he said as he tried to steady himself after the stoning, "to expose myself, to bring this hate into the open." He had marched in the deepest corners of Alabama, but was unprepared for what he was in for in Chicago. "I have seen many demonstrations in the South," he said that violent day in the Promised Land, "but I have never seen anything so hostile and so hateful as I've seen here today." Ida May watched it on the news that night and worried for the man she so badly had wanted to see. She expected this in Mississippi, not in the North. "No," she would say decades afterward. "Some places I just trusted more than others." New York, Pennsylvania Station, mid-1960s. George Swanson Starling. The world was changing, and George, without trying, was on the front lines. In the South, the trains had been segregated for as long as most people had been alive. Now he was in the uncomfortable position of enforcing new laws that were just now filtering into everyday practice. There he was, scanning the crowds on the railroad platform as the southbound Silver Comet stretched down the track, belching and ready to board. The train would pull out of the station at 12:45 en route to Birmingham with some 28 stops in between. Passengers packed the railway platform, suitcases, hat boxes, overnighters, trunks, briefcases, and Gimbel's shopping bags at their feet. George went about his job of getting their luggage and helping them to their seats, but this time he looked the passengers over in a way he never did before. He looked to see if they were in prim Sunday clothes or loud juke-joint get-ups. If the people seeing them off were self-contained New Yorkers bidding people goodbye, or excitable Southerners still new to the spectacle. He checked to see if they haughtily took to their reserved seats in the integrated rail car as if they owned it, or if they were wide-eyed and tentative about sitting in the same section as the white passengers. George was paying close attention because this was the mid-1960s. The trains in the North had always been integrated, but blacks had to move to separate cars before being permitted into the South. During the run between New York and Alabama, it had been George's job to move the colored passengers from their seats in the white section and into the Jim Crow car before crossing from Washington into the segregated state of Virginia. But after the sit-ins and marches in the South, things were beginning to change. President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act on July 2, 1964, 101 years after Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, granting rights that would have to be spelled out again long after Lincoln was gone. Now blacks were entitled to the same privileges as any other citizens. They were not to be segregated in any sphere in life. But it would take time, up to a decade or more, for the message to sink in to those who chose not to recognize the new law. In addition, it was not as if a copy of the Civil Rights Act went out to every black household. Some didn't know what their new rights were exactly, and had lived under the old order for so long that they were tentative about testing out the new one. In public conveyances, it fell to workers like George Starling, if they were so inclined, which it so happened he was, to alert their fellow migrants to rights they weren't certain they could assert. On the train, it meant negotiating the tricky business of reorienting the black passengers when the train passed into or out of what had been Jim Crow territory. For as long as most anyone alive could remember, this was the way things had worked on the railroad. a black passenger boarding a southbound train at, say, Pennsylvania Station in New York, would be assigned a seat anywhere on the train and could sit there without a second thought until the train reached the border city of Washington, D.C. From the time of Reconstruction in the 1870s, Washington had been the dividing line between the free North and the segregated South. Black passengers getting off in Washington had nothing to worry about. But for those continuing South, the crews who ran the train, the porters who helped passengers on and off, and the black passengers themselves, knew to gather their things and move to the Jim Crow car up front to make sure the races were separated when the train crossed into the state of Virginia. The civil rights legislation of the mid-1960s changed all that, or was intended to, but custom had a way of lingering well after the ink was dry. So in the transition to integration, black passengers were not automatically granted the right to keep their seats, no matter what their ticket or President Johnson said. George was on the front lines in these early days of integration, when some conductors, many of them Southern, held close the old traditions and ordered porters like George to move the colored passengers into the Jim Crow car, no matter the law. Some conductors, like many other Southerners, resented the new laws that had been forced upon them. Others could always say that white Southerners boarding the train below Washington were still not comfortable riding in the same coach as black people and might kick up a fuss. As the train drew closer to Washington, the conductor gave George a passenger manifest identifying the passengers he wanted moved to the old Jim Crow car, meaning all the black passengers traveling below Washington. George knew it wasn't right and began discreetly approaching colored passengers as the train pulled out of Baltimore en route to Washington. He tried to alert them to what was about to happen and let them know they had a right to stay where they were. But it was a perilous act on his part. The passengers might get scared and turn him in. He might be accused of inciting the passengers and disrupting the orderly relocation of passengers who didn't mind moving. It was especially dangerous because he was not heading north on the train, but south into what might be considered enemy territory. Either way, he could be fired for what he was doing. He knew he couldn't be seen openly advising black passengers to defy the conductor's orders. So from the moment he boarded the train in New York and began waiting on the black passengers in his charge, he paid close attention to them, scrutinized them to see which ones might be more receptive. Then, as the train rumbled toward Union Station in Washington, and when he had made certain that the conductor wasn't around, he began approaching colored passengers one by one. He leaned over the seat and began speaking in whispers. "Look," he told them, "what I want to say to you is confidential between you and me. If you don't think you can keep it confidential, let me know now, and I won't say any more. But it's to your benefit."
"Okay, okay."
Then he would explain the situation. "Well, now, going below Washington," he would tell them, "they want us to move y'all up front in the Jim Crow car. But you have paid for a seat to wherever you're going. You paid an extra fee to reserve this seat, and you're entitled to keep this seat to your point of destination. But they're not going to tell you that. They're going to tell you you got to move up front." He waited for their response, checked for a show of interest and curiosity instead of fear and distrust. Then he would know whether to proceed. If he felt safe, he would go on. "What you do," he continued, "is tell them that you don't care to move. Just tell them that." Then he told them what to expect and gave them a little script. "They're going to give you an argument," he said, "but just tell them, 'Look, I have a reserved seat here from New York to Jacksonville. Washington isn't my destination, and I'm not moving anywhere. Now, if you want me to move, you get the cops and come and move me. I'm not voluntarily moving anywhere.'" He reassured them that they were within their rights. "They're not going to bother you," he told them, "because they know if you got nerve enough to tell them that you're not going to move, and if they force you to move, that they have a suit on their hands." But it occurred to him that he needed to protect himself. He couldn't give any appearance of undermining the conductor's orders or inspiring the black passengers to do something that would otherwise never occur to them. So he admonished them further.
"And don't go telling them, 'Well, the attendant told me I didn't have to move,'" George said, "or you'll get me killed. Just tell them you're not going to move. They're not going to move you."
Some of them got scared at that kind of talk, so George gave them an out.
"If you feel more comfortable and you think you should go on up to that Jim Crow car when you have paid to ride like everybody else, then you go," he said. "I'll move you."
He forewarned them that if they decided to take the chance, they should know that he would have to feign indifference, pretend to have no knowledge of the matter if the conductor got involved.
"He's going to be telling me to take you up front, and you're going to be telling him that you're not going, and I'm going to just be standing there. I'm going to be saying, 'No, I ain't got nothing to do with it.'"
By the time the train got halfway to Washington, he had a good idea of who he had in the rail car with him and which of them might be safe to approach.
"You could tell just by who brings them to the station," he said, "how they depart, the conversations."
But sometimes he would misjudge a passenger and come close to getting caught. Some passengers would loud talk him.
"What? What the hell you talking about?" they'd ask, not comprehending his plan.
George would speak in an even quieter whisper to get their voices down, which only meant they couldn't hear him and made them ask more questions, even louder than before.
"What? I don't have to move? How come I don't have to move?"
George would just shake his head and step away.
"You know to leave them alone," he said.
What gave George the greatest sense of defeat were the people who went up to the Jim Crow car anyway.
"They move anyway to avoid trouble," he said. "Quite a few would move up because the other attendants, they wouldn't tell the people. They wouldn't go to them like I would. Some of them would even support the conductor in telling them, 'You better move. You gotta move.'"
George didn't see it that way, and after all he had been through in the South, and even in the North, he felt it his duty to let the people know. It was the same George who tried to rouse the fruit pickers some 20 years before to get them to stand up for what was due them. In this case on the train, George was fortunate.
"None of them ever exposed me," he said.
And what's more, of the cases he saw, the people who resisted got to stay in their rightful seats.
"Every incident that came up," George said, "they left them alone."
Chicago, spring 1967. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. It had been close to 30 years since Ida Mae and her family had come up north. The children were grown now, and by the late 1950s, the first generation born in the north had arrived. Eleanor, who had come north in Ida Mae's belly, had gotten married right out of high school and had 2 kids. James and his wife Mary Ann soon followed with 4 kids of their own. Ida Mae held the babies close and prayed for the first members of the family, born free in the promised land. There were different branches now, and they were getting by, but still renting, and not settled in a place of their own. From flat to flat, in and around the straining borders of the South Side, Ida Mae and her family had moved more in Chicago than they had when they were sharecroppers in Mississippi, as they had never moved in Mississippi like some of the people they knew, because they had always stayed with their one planter, Mr. Ed. They had lived at 21st and State, 33rd and State, 45th and St. Lawrence, and were now in the 700 block of West 66th Place. They had been all over the South Side. They felt they had been in Chicago long enough without owning something. George had been at Campbell Soup for years. Ida Mae was working as a nurse's aide at Walther Memorial Hospital. Velma was teaching, James was driving a bus for the Chicago Transit Authority. Eleanor was a ticket agent for the elevated train. So together they had enough to put something down on some property. Not unlike many immigrant families, they wanted to stay together and wanted a place big enough for all of them. Their search led them to a beige brick 3-flat in a long-contested, but they believed, newly opened-up neighborhood called South Shore, on the southern tip of the Black Belt.
It was a few blocks west of Lake Michigan. The street was lined with oak trees along the sidewalk and brick bungalows and multi-flats with little patches of yard in front. They went to see the place at night. An Italian car salesman and his family lived there. It had room enough for James and his family on the first floor, Ida May and her husband on the second, Eleanor and her kids on the third, or if necessary, a tenant to help with the house payments. Ida May and her family didn't have enough furniture to fill the flat. They wanted the place and everything in it. The plastic-covered upholstery, the marble-topped coffee table, the lamps, the dining room table, the break front and buffet, and the baby blue draperies over the front windows. The Italian car salesman said he liked them and wanted them to have it. The family paid $30,000 and moved in without incident. There was the little matter of a bullet hole in one of the windows in the front room, but Ida May didn't let it bother her as it appeared the shot had been fired sometime before they moved in. 30 years after they arrived in the new world, with little more than their kids and the clothes on their backs, Ida May and her husband were finally homeowners in Chicago. "It was beautiful," Ida May said years later. "Trees everywhere, all up and down the block." Weeks passed. Ida May went to work one morning and came back that evening on the streetcar over on Exchange. She walked down Colfax in the neighborhood of brick apartment buildings, barbershop storefronts, and frame bungalows along a route that she was just beginning to learn. It was then that she noticed something missing across the street from her three flat. A house had vanished. The people across from her had moved it, or so it appeared. There was now a small crater in the earth where just that morning a house used to be. It was a wonderment to Ida May and to James and Eleanor and the grandkids. Why would their nice white neighbors move their house clear off the street? Where did they go? What did this mean? They would never see them again to get the answers. They would never fully know for sure what had happened or why. It would become part of their family lore, one of the things they would tell over and over again, shaking their heads and hunching their shoulders as they looked out their second-floor window at the sociology unfolding beneath them. As it was, too much was happening anyway. Within weeks of the disappearing house, moving vans clogged Colfax Street. More people were vanishing, but those people left their houses behind. They took their sofas and upright pianos and were gone. "Lord, they move quick," Ida May said years later. "And then Black started moving in. Oh, Lord." The whites left so fast, Ida May didn't get a chance to know any of them or their kids or what they did for a living or if they liked watching the Ed Sullivan Show like she did Sunday nights. They didn't stick around long enough to explain. But some of the whites who left the South Side in a panic would talk about it years later, and to tell the truth, never got over the loss of their old neighborhoods. "It happened slowly, and then all of a sudden, boom," said a white homemaker who fled Ida May's neighborhood around that time and was quoted by the writer Lewis Rosen, who had been a teenager when his parents fled South Shore, in the book South Side. "Everyone was gone. Everything changed. Before you know it, this one, that one. And then you heard, so-and-so's moving." People didn't want to be the last. A white father told Rosen, "I fought the good fight. I couldn't stay there with my three kids. My oldest was only 14 at the time. I made a judgment. I did the best I could." "It was like sitting around with a big group," said a white husband. "Okay, guys, in the next year, we're all going." "It was who found a house first," the wife chimed in. "Exactly, and we all went," the husband said. To the colored people left behind, none of it made any sense. "It was like having a tooth pulled for no reason," said a black resident who moved his family in, only to watch the white neighbors empty out. By the end of the year, the 7,500 block of Colfax and much of the rest of South Shore went from all white to nearly totally black, which in itself might have been a neutral development, except that many houses changed hands so rapidly it was unclear whether the new people could afford the mortgages and the rest were abandoned to renters with no investment or incentive to keep the places up. The turnover was sudden and complete, and so destabilizing that it even extended to the stores on 75th Street, to the neighborhood schools, and to the street sweeping and police patrols that could have kept up the quality of life. It was as if the city lost interest when the white people left. The ice cream parlor closed, the Five and Dime shut down, the Walgreens on the corner became a liquor store. Karen and Kevin enrolled in Bradwell Elementary School and remember being along with two other black kids, the only black children in the entire school in 1968. By the time they graduated 4 years later, the racial composition had completely reversed. Only four white children were left. South Shore would become as solidly black as the North Shore was solidly white. Ida Mae's neighborhood never had a chance to catch up with all the upheaval and was never the same again. South Shore was one of the last white strongholds on the South Side, the completion of a cycle that had begun when the migrants first arrived and started looking for a way out of the tenements. There were 58 bombings of houses that blacks moved into, or were about to move into, between 1917 and 1921 alone, bombings having become one of the preferred methods of intimidation in the North. In neighborhood after neighborhood, with the arrival of black residents, the response during the migration years was swift and predictable. It happened to ordinary people like Ida Mae and to celebrities like Mahalia Jackson, the leading gospel singer of her day. When she began looking for a house in a well-to-do section of the South Side, people held meetings up and down the block. A Catholic priest rallied his parishioners and told them not to sell to her. "You'd have thought the atomic bomb was coming instead of me," the singer said. She got calls in the middle of the night warning her, "You move into that house and we'll blow it up with dynamite. You're going to need more than your gospel songs and prayers to save you." She bought the house. It was a sprawling red brick ranch and the house of her dreams, coming as she had from the back country of Louisiana. A doctor had broken ranks and sold it to her. As soon as she moved in, the neighbors shot rifle bullets through her windows. The police were posted outside her house for close to a year. "One by one," she said, "they sold their houses and moved away. As fast as a house came on the market, a colored family would buy it." Even Hyde Park, an island of sophistication just north of Ida Mae's working-class neighborhood of South Shore, succumbed to the same fears and raw emotion that overtook the rest of the city's South Side. "Shall we sacrifice our property for a third of its value and run like rats from a burning ship?" said a handbill circulated among white residents trying to keep blacks on the other side of State Street. "Or shall we put up a united front to keep Hyde Park desirable for ourselves?" Oddly enough, Hyde Park was one of the very few places where the alarmist rhetoric did not completely take. It was home to the venerable University of Chicago, which had its own interest in maintaining stability, and the neighborhood was blessed with some of the finest residential architecture in the city, giving many whites compelling and overriding reasons to stay. The neighborhood was one of the most expensive on the South Side, so blacks who moved there had to have the means just to get in. Thus, Hyde Park actually became a rare island of integration, despite the initial hostilities. Still, it was surrounded by all-black neighborhoods in a deeply divided city. Entire communities like the suburb of Cicero remained completely off-limits to blacks, and whites would avoid so much as driving through whole sections of the South and West Sides for the remainder of the century. By the time the migration reached its conclusion, sociologists would have a name for that kind of hardcore racial division. They would call it hypersegregation, a kind of separation of the races that was so total and complete that blacks and whites rarely intersected outside of work. The top 10 cities that would earn that designation after the 1980 census, the last census after the close of the Great Migration, which statistically ended in the 1970s, were, in order of severity of racial isolation from most segregated to least, 1, Chicago, 2, Detroit, 3, Cleveland, 4, Milwaukee. 5, Newark. 6, Gary, Indiana. 7, Philadelphia. 8, Los Angeles. 9, Baltimore. And 10, St. Louis. All of them receiving stations of the Great Migration. New York, late summer, 1967. George Swanson Starling. There came a time in the lives of many migrants' children when the parents sent them south for the summer to protect them from the uncaring streets of the Promised Land, or to learn the culture of their family of origin, or of the old country itself. It was a ritual practiced, more or less, by most families to ensure that their children knew where they came from. George and Inez Starling sent their daughter Sonia down to Eustis when she was 13. What happened there was the last thing they expected. She got pregnant. "It almost killed my wife," George said. It was devastating after all they had been through and was the beginning of the most trying season of their lives. They had been married for 28 years. Theirs had not been a happy union, but at least they had a family and had made out okay in New York, almost in spite of themselves, because they were hard workers and deep down good and decent people. They had the highest hopes for their children, raised in a world free of the hardships they had endured in Florida. And now it was as if the South and the backbiting country town they had left had reached back and punished them for having had the nerve to leave. George had made a winless bargain. He had taken a job that kept him away from the very people he was working so hard to take care of, and he could not undo the damage already done. His absence only created a bigger gulf between him and Inez, and left the children without a father most of the time, and a mother with demons of her own to raise them practically by herself. When they learned of Sonia's pregnancy, George would not admit his pain. He reacted with resignation and had little sympathy for the despair Inez felt, just as all those years before she had had little sympathy for his earnestness in organizing the pickers in the citrus groves. The wounds they both carried had hardened and calcified, and the crisis over Sonia, what would become of her, what kind of future would she have, how would they manage to raise the baby, only widened the chasm. Each blamed the other and themselves. When he finally spoke, George's words cut deep. He said Sonia was no different from Inez. "It wasn't on account of your purity," he told her, with the barbed edge that seemed to characterize more and more of their interactions, "that it didn't happen to us. You can't deny it because you were doing it with me." Sonia gave birth to a baby boy she named Brian. It was 1968. She was 14. George, fatalistic now after all they had been through, said all he could do was laugh. The sins of the father were visiting the children. He thought back to when he was in the 10th grade and a girl in his class turned up pregnant. "She named me the father," he said. His first reaction was, how did she know that he was the father, that just about anybody could have been the father? His second reaction was that there went his future. For the rest of his life, he would be picking fruit during the citrus season and digging up palmetto roots the rest of the time, pretty much the only work around. "Let me finish the 11th grade," he remembered telling the grown folks. "I'd just like to finish out the 11th grade. I don't mind doing the right thing." The baby was born dead. "I was so relieved," George said. "I never tried to find out if it was mine." Now his daughter had come to him with the same news the girl he dallied with in high school had broken to her family all those years ago. "Now you know," he thought to himself. "Now you know how that mother felt when her daughter said she was pregnant by you." And so when the crisis over Sonia came up, George could only laugh through his tears at how much of what he had sown he appeared to be reaping. "I never did tell my wife," George said. "I didn't try to tell my wife why I was laughing. It was retribution." It was retribution on several fronts. At around the same time that Sonia got pregnant, so did another woman. It was a woman George had been going out with behind Inez's back. As their marriage strained under the weight of unspoken resentments, he gave in to temptation. It only made the unpleasant matters even worse, and life nearly unbearable for Inez, the discovery of two pregnancies she never would have imagined or wished for. The sadness and irony seemed to be turning in on itself, and it all seemed to point back to the rash and fateful day that George tried to get back at his father by marrying Inez in